charging up to the maiden's tower, so mad with desire that he forgets his sword and is slain by the dragon before even getting near her. Except that the dragon in this case was a battalion of ghosts whom no sword could harm. And he didn't have a sword anyway. At best, he had a padded pole. A true hero's weapon. This problem, by which he meant not the interrupted kiss, but this whole ungodly impasse of city and citadel, would not be solved by slaying. There had been too much of that already. How it would be solved, he didn't know. But he knew this. The stakes were higher than anyone else realized. And the stakes, for him now, were personal. From the day the Godslayer rode through the gates in Zosma and issued his extraordinary invitation, throughout the recruitment of experts and all their endless speculation, to finally laying eyes on Weep, Laszlo had felt a certain freedom from expectation. Oh, he wanted to help. Badly. He'd daydreamed about it. But in all of that, no one was looking to him for solutions. And he hadn't been looking to himself for them either. He'd merely been wistful. "What could I do?" went the refrain. He was no alchemist, no builder, no expert on metals or magnets. But now the nature of the problem had changed. It wasn't just metals and magnets anymore, but ghosts and gods and magic and vengeance. And while he wouldn't call himself an expert in any of those things, he had more to recommend him than the others did, starting with an open mind. And open hearts. Sarai was up there. Her life was at stake. So Laszlo didn't ask himself, "What could I do?" That morning as the second Sabbat of Twelfth Moon dawned in the city of Weep. But, "What will I do?" It was a noble question, and if destiny had seen fit to reveal its staggering answer to him then, he would never have believed it. Errol Fane and Azarine came for breakfast, and Laszlo saw them through the lens of everything he'd learned in the night, and his hearts ached for them. Suhaila set out steamed buns and boiled eggs and tea. They sat down, all four of them, on the cushions around the low stone table in the courtyard. Suhaila knew nothing yet but what she sensed, that something had happened, that something had changed.
"So," she asked, "what did you find up there, really? I take it that the story about the pontoon was a lie."
"Not exactly a lie," said Laszlo. "The pontoon did spring a leak." He took a sip of tea. "With some help from a meat hook." Suhaila's cup clattered onto her saucer.
"A meat hook?"
she repeated, eyes wide, then narrow.
"How did the pontoon happen to encounter a meat hook?"
The question was directed at Laszlo, since he seemed more inclined to speak than the other two. He turned to Errol Fane and Azarine. It seemed their business to do it, not his. They began with the ghosts. In fact, they named a great many of them, beginning with Azarine's grandmother. There were more than Laszlo realized. Uncles, neighbors, acquaintances. Suhaila wept in silence. Even a cousin who died a few days ago, a young man named Ariel, had been seen. They were all pale and sick with the implications. The citizens of Weep, it would seem, were captive even in death.
"Either we've all been damned, and the citadel is our hell," said Suhaila, shaking. "Or there's another explanation."
She fixed her son with a steady gaze. She wasn't one to give credence to hell, and was braced for the truth. He cleared his throat and said, with enormous difficulty,
"There is a survivor up there."
Suhaila paled.
"A survivor?"
She swallowed hard.
"Godsborn?"
"A girl," said Errol Fane.
He had to clear his throat again. Every syllable seemed to fight him.
"With Red hair.
Five simple words. A girl with red hair. And what a torrent of emotion they unleashed. If silence could crash, it did. If it could break like a wave and flood a room with all the force of the ocean, it did. Azarine seemed carved of stone. Suhaila gripped the edge of the table. Laszlo reached out a hand to steady her.
Alive!
She gasped, and her gaze was pinned to her son. Laszlo could see the ricochet of feeling in her, the tentative surge of hope flinching back toward the firmer ground of dread. Her grandchild was alive. Her grandchild was Godsborn. Her grandchild was alive.
Tell me,
she said, desperate to hear more.
I have nothing more to tell, said Errol Fane. I only saw her for an instant.
Did she attack you?
Asked Suhaila. He shook his head, seeming puzzled. It was Azarine who answered.
She warned us,
she said. Her brow was furrowed, her eyes haunted.
I don't know why, but we would all be dead if it weren't for her.
A brittle silence settled. They all traded looks across the table, so stunned and full of questions that Laszlo finally spoke.
Her name is Sarai, he said,
and their three heads swung to face him. He had been silent, set apart from the violence of their emotion. Those five words, a girl with red hair, created such an opposite effect in him. Tenderness, delight, desire. His voice carried all of it when he said her name, in an echo of the rabbit's purr in which he'd said it to her.
How could you know that?
Asked Azarine, the first to recover from her surprise. Her tone was blunt and skeptical.
She told me,
Laszlo said.
She can go into dreams. It's her gift.
She came into mine.
They all considered this.
How do you know it was real? Errol Fane asked.
They're not like any dreams I've had before, Laszlo said.
How could he put it into words, what it was like being with Sarai?
I know how it sounds, but I dreamed her before I ever saw her. Before I even saw the mural and knew the Mazarthim were blue. That was why I asked you that day. I thought she must be Izagol, because I didn't know about the...
He hesitated. This was their secret shame, and it had been kept from him. The Godsborn. The word was as terrible as the name Weep.
The children,
he said instead.
But I know now. I know all of it.
Errol Fane stared at him, but it was the blind, unblinking stare of someone seeing into the past.
Then you know what I did.
Laszlo nodded. When he looked at Errol Fane now, what did he see? A hero? A butcher? Did they cancel each other out? Or would butcher always trump hero? Could they exist side by side, two such opposites, like the love and hate he'd borne for 3 long years?
I had to, said the Godslayer. We couldn't suffer them to live. Not with magic that would set them above us, to conquer us all over again when they grew up. The risk was too great.
It all had the ring of something oft repeated, and his look appealed to Laszlo to understand. Laszlo didn't. When Sarai told him what Errol Fane had done, he'd believed the Godslayer must repent of it now. But here he was, defending the slaughter.
They were innocent, he said.
The Godslayer seemed to shrink in on himself.
I know. Do you think I wanted to do it? There was no other way. There was no place for them in this world.
And now?
Laszlo asked. He felt cold. This wasn't the conversation he had expected to be having. They should have been figuring out a plan. Instead, his question was met with silence. the only possible interpretation of which was, there was still no place for them in this world.
"She's your daughter," he said. "She's not some monster. She's afraid. She's kind."
Errol Fane shrank further. The two women closed ranks around him. Azarine flashed Laszlo a warning look, and Suhaila reached for her son's hand.
"And what of our dead, trapped up there?" she asked. "Is that kind?"
"That isn't her doing,"
Laszlo said, not to dismiss the threat, but at least to exonerate Sarai.
"It must be one of the others."
Errol Fane flinched.
"Others?"
How deep and tangled the roots of hatred were, thought Laszlo, seeing how even now, with remorse and self-loathing like a 15 years canker eating him from within, the Godslayer could hardly tell whether he wished the Godspawn unslain, or feared them so. As for Laszlo, he was uneasy with the information. He felt sick in the pit of his stomach, to fear that he couldn't trust Errol Fane.
"There are other survivors," was all he said.
Survivors. There was so much in that word. Strength, resilience, luck, along with the shadow of whatever crime or cruelty had been survived. In this case, Errol Fane was that crime, that cruelty. They had survived him, and the shadow fell very dark on him.
"Sarai saved us," Laszlo said quietly. "Now we have to save her and the others too. You're Errol Fane. It's up to you. The people will follow your lead."
"It isn't that simple, Laszlo," said Suhaila. "There's no way you could understand the hate. It's like a disease."
He was beginning to understand. How had Sarai put it? "The hate of the used and tormented, who are the children of the used and tormented, and whose own children will be used and tormented."
"So what are you saying?
What do you mean to do?"
He braced himself and asked.
"Kill them?"
"No," said Errol Fane. "No."
It was an answer to the question, but it came out as though he were warding off a nightmare or a blow, as though even the idea was an assault and he couldn't bear it. He put his face in his hand, head bowed. Azarine sat apart, watching him, her eyes dark and liquid and so full of pain that she might have been made of it. Suhaila, eyes brimming with tears, laid her one good hand on her son's shoulder.
"I'll take the second silk sleigh," he said, lifting his head,
and while the women's eyes were wet, his were dry.
"I'll go up and meet with them."
Azarine and Suhaila immediately objected.
"And offer yourself as sacrifice?"
demanded Azarine.
"What would that accomplish?"
"It seems to me you barely escaped with your lives,"
Suhaila pointed out more gently. He looked to Laszlo, and there was a helplessness in him, as though he wanted Laszlo to tell him what to do.
"I'll talk to Sarai tonight," he volunteered.
"I'll ask if she can persuade the others to call a truce."
"How do you know she'll come again?"
Laszlo blushed, and worried they could see it all written on his face.
"She said she would,"
he lied. They'd run out of time to make plans, but she didn't need to say it. Night couldn't come soon enough, and he was sure she felt the same. And next time, he wouldn't wait until the precise strike of dawn before drawing her close. He cleared his throat.
"If she says it's safe, we can go up tomorrow."
"We," said Errol Fane. "No, not you. I'll risk no one but myself."
Azarine looked sharply away at that, and in the bleakness of her eyes, Laszlo saw a shade of the anguish of loving someone who doesn't love himself.
"Oh, I'm going with you,"
Laszlo said. Not with force, but simple resolve. He was imagining disembarking from the sleigh onto the Seraph's palm, and Sarai standing before him, as real as his own flesh and blood. He had to be there. Whatever look these musings produced upon his face, Errol Fane didn't try to argue him out of it. As for Azarine, neither would she be left behind. But first, the five up in the Citadel had to agree to it, and that couldn't happen until tomorrow. Meanwhile, there was today to deal with. Laszlo was to go to the Merchants' Guild Hall this morning and ask Solzarin and Oswin, privately, to conjure some likely excuse for delaying the launch of the second silk sleigh. Everyone would be expecting them to follow up yesterday's failed ascension with a success, which, of course, they couldn't do, at least not yet. As for the secret, it would be kept from the citizens. Errol Fane considered keeping it from the Tysakane, too, for fear that it would cause them too much turmoil and prove too difficult to hide. But Azarine was staunch on their behalf, and argued that they needed to be ready for anything that happened.
"They can bear it," she said, adding softly, "they don't need to know all of it yet."
She meant Sarai, Laszlo understood, and whose child she was.
"There's something I don't understand," he said,
as he prepared to take his leave. It seemed to him it was the mystery at the center of everything to do with the Godspawn. Sarai said there were 30 of them in the nursery that day. Errol Fane looked sharply down at his hands. The muscles in his jaw clenched. Laszlo was uncomfortable pressing onward in this bloody line of inquiry, and he was far from certain he really wanted an answer. But it felt too important not to delve deeper.
"And though that's no small number, it's got to be just a fraction."
He was imagining the nursery as a row of identical cribs. Because he hadn't been in the Citadel and seen how everything was Mazathium, he substituted rough wooden cribs, little more than open crates, like the ones the monks kept infant orphans in at the Abbey. Here was the thing that nagged at Laszlo like a missing tooth. He himself had been an infant in a row of identical cribs, and he shared a name with countless other foundlings to show for it. There had been a lot of them, a lot of strangers, and there were still a lot of them.
"What about all the others?"
he asked, looking from Errol Fane to Azarine, and lastly to Suhaila, who, he suspected, had been delivered of one herself.
"The ones who weren't babies anymore. If the Mazathim were doing this all along,
this..." He shuddered at his own craven circumlocution, using so meaningless a word to obscure so hideous a truth. Breeding. That was what they'd been doing, hadn't they?
Why? "Over 2 centuries, he pressed. "There had to have been thousands of children."
Their three faces all wore the same bleak look. He saw that they understood him. They might have stepped in and saved him coming out with it, but they didn't. So he put it bluntly.
"What happened to all the rest?"
Suhaila answered. Her voice was lifeless.
"We don't know," she said. "We don't know what the gods did with them."
Chapter 49 Veil of Reverie. There was no beauty sleep for Thion Nero. Quite the opposite.
"It might not kill you," Strange had said, "but it will make you ugly."
Thion recalled the jest, the easy teasing tone of it, as he drew another long, ill-advised syringeful of spirit from his own overtaxed veins. It couldn't be helped. He had to make more Azoth at once. A control batch, as it were, after the inexplicable results of last night's test. He had washed all his glassware and instruments carefully. He might have requested an assistant to do such menial chores, but he was too jealous of his secret to let anyone into his laboratory. Anyway, even if he'd had an assistant, he would have washed these flasks himself. It was the only way to be certain that there were no impurities in the equation, and no unknown factor that might affect the results. He had always eschewed the mystical side of alchemy and focused on pure science. Such was the basis of his success. Empirical reality. Results. Repeatable, verifiable. The solidity of truth you could hold in your hands. Even as he read the stories in Miracles for Breakfast, he was mining it for clues. It was science he was after. Traces of science, anyway. Like dust shaken from a tapestry of wonder. And when he reread the stories, still it was research. When he read them to fall asleep, a habit that was as deep a secret as the recipe for Azoth, it was possible that he might drift into a kind of reverie that felt more mystical than material. But they were fairy tales, after all. And it was only in those moments when his mind shut off its rigor. Whatever it was gone by morning. But morning had come. He might have no windows to attest to it, but he had a watch, ticking steadily. The sun had risen, and Thion Nero wasn't reading fairy tales now. He was distilling Azoth, as he had done hundreds of times before. So why had that shimmering veil of reverie been drawn over him now? He shook it off. Whatever accounted for the results of his experiments, it wasn't mystical. And neither was Mesarthium itself, and neither was spirit. There was a scientific explanation for everything. Even gods. Chapter 50. The whole day to get through. In the citadel and in the city, Sarai and Laszlo each felt the tug of the other, like a string fixed between their hearts, another between their lips, where their kiss had barely begun, and a third from the pit of her belly to his, where new enticement stirred. Soft, insistent, delirious, the tug. If only they could gather up the strings and wind themselves nearer, nearer, until finally meeting in the middle. But there was the whole day to get through before it was time, again, for dreams. Waking from her first kiss, still flush with the magic of the extraordinary night, Sarai had been buoyant and alive with new hope. The world seemed more beautiful, less brutal, and so did the future, because Laszlo was in it. She lay warm in her bed, her fingers playing over her own smile, as though encountering it for the first time. She felt new to herself, not an obscene thing that made ghosts recoil, but a poem, a fairy tale. In the wake of the dream, anything seemed possible. Even freedom. Even love. But it was hard to hold on to that feeling, as reality reasserted itself. She was still a prisoner, for starters, with Minya's army preventing her from leaving her room. When she tried to shoulder through them to the door, they gripped her arms, right over the bruises they'd made the day before, and hauled her back. Les Ellen never came with her morning tray. Nor did Faisy or Awis with the fresh pitcher of water they always brought first thing. Sarai had used the last of her water yesterday to clean the wound on her arm, and woke dehydrated. No doubt her weeping in the night hadn't helped, with nothing to drink. She was thirsty. She was hungry. Did Minya mean to starve her? She had nothing at all until Great Ellen came in sometime in early afternoon, with her apron full of plums.
"Oh, thank goodness,"
said Sarai. But when she looked at Great Ellen, she was disturbed by what she saw. It was the ghost's beloved face, matronly and broad, with her round, red, happiness cheeks. But there was nothing happy to be found in her effect, as flat as all the ghosts in Minya's army. And when she spoke, the rhythm of her voice was not her own, but recognizably Minya's.
"Even traitors must be fed," she said.
And then she dropped the hem of her apron, and dumped the plums onto the floor.
What?
Asked Sarai, jumping back as they went rolling every way. As the ghost turned away, Sarai saw how her eyeballs strained to stay fixed for as long as possible on her, and she read pain in them, and apology. Her hands shook as she picked up the plums. The first few she ate still crouched there. Her mouth and throat were so dry. The juice was heavenly, but it was tainted by the manner of its delivery, and by the horror of Minya using Great Ellen in such a way. Sarai ate 5 plums, then crawled around on the floor until she had gathered up all the rest of them and shoved them into the pockets of her robe. She could have eaten more, but she didn't know how long they'd have to last her. Yesterday, trapped alone in her room, she'd felt despair. Today, she didn't reprise it. Instead, she got mad. At Minya, of course, but the others too. The ghosts had no free will. But what about Feral and Ruby and Sparrow? Where were they? If it were one of them being punished, she wouldn't just accept it and go about her day. She would fight for them, even against Minya. Did they really believe she had betrayed them? She hadn't chosen humans over Godspawn, but life over death, for all their sakes. Couldn't they see that? Under the influence of Lull, Sarai's days had been nothing but dreamless grey moments between one night and the next. This day was the opposite. It would not end. She watched the squares of sunlight that her windows threw on the floor. They ought to have moved with the angle of the sun, but she was sure they were frozen in place. Of course, today would be the day the sun got stuck in the sky. The gears of the heavens had gotten gummed up, and now it would be daytime forever. Why not nighttime forever? Laszlo and nighttime forever. Sarai's belly fluttered, and she yearned for the escape that nightfall would bring, if indeed it ever came. Sleep would help pass the time, if she dared. She certainly needed it. The little rest she'd gotten, asleep in Laszlo's dream, hadn't even begun to allay her fatigue. These past days, hunted by nightmares, she'd felt their presence, even while she was awake. She felt them now, too, and she was still afraid. She just wasn't terrified anymore. And that was rather wonderful. She considered her options. She could pace, bitter and frantic and feeling every second of her deprivation and frustration as the sun dawdled its way across the sky. Or she could go to the door, stand in front of her ghost guards, and scream down the corridor until Minya came. And then what? Or she could fall asleep and maybe fight nightmares, and maybe win, and hurry the day on its way. It wasn't a choice, really. Sarai was tired, and she wasn't terrified. So she lay down in her bed, tucked her hands under her cheek, and slept. Laszlo looked up at the citadel and wondered, for the 100th time that day, what Sarai was doing. Was she sleeping? If she was she fending off nightmares on her own? He stared at the metal angel and focused his mind, as though by doing so he could give her strength. Also for the 100th time that day, he remembered the kiss. It might have been brief, but so much of a kiss, a first kiss especially, is the moment before your lips touch, and before your eyes close, when you're filled with the sight of each other, and with the compulsion, the pull, and it's like finding a book inside another book. A small treasure of a book, hidden inside a big common one, like spells printed on dragonfly wings, discovered tucked inside a cookery book, right between the recipes for cabbages and corn. That's what a kiss is like, he thought, no matter how brief. It's a tiny, magical story, and a miraculous interruption of the mundane. Laszlo was more than ready for the mundane to be interrupted again.
What time is it?
He asked Ruza, glaring at the sky. Where it showed around the citadel's edges, it was damnably bright and blue. He'd never felt anger at the sky before. Even the interminable days of the Elmuthaleth crossing had passed more quickly than this one.
Do I look like a clock?
Inquired the warrior.
Is my face round? Are there numbers on it?
If your face were a clock,
Laszlo reasoned slowly,
I wouldn't ask you what time it was. I'd just look at you.
Fair point,
admitted Ruza. It was an ordinary day, if at least 10 times longer than it ought to have been. Solzarin and Oswin did as asked, and produced a credible reason to delay a second launch. No one questioned it. The citizens were relieved, while the Ferengi were simply occupied. Thion Nero wasn't the only one exhausting himself, though he was the only one siphoning off his own vital essence to do it. They were all deeply engaged, hard at work, and competitive. Well, they were all deeply engaged and competitive, and all with the exception of Drave, were also hard at work. Though, to be fair, this wasn't his fault. He'd have liked nothing better than to blow something up, but it was clear to everyone, himself included, that he and his powder were on hand as a last resort. When all else fails, explosions. This did not sit well with him.
How am I supposed to win the reward if I'm not allowed to do anything?
He demanded of Laszlo that afternoon, waylaying him outside the Tizerkane guard station, where he'd stopped to talk with Ruza and Zara and some of the other warriors. Laszlo was unsympathetic. Drave was being compensated for his time, just like everyone else. And as for the reward, Drave's personal fortune wasn't high on his list of priorities.
I don't know, he answered. You might come up with a solution to the problem that doesn't involve destruction.
Drave scoffed.
Doesn't involve destruction? That's like me asking you not to be a mealy-mouthed poltroon.
Laszlo's eyebrows shot up.
Poltroon?
Look it up,
snapped Drave. Laszlo turned to Ruza.
Do you think I'm a poltroon?
He asked, the way a young girl might ask whether her dress was unflattering.
I don't know what that is. I think it's a kind of mushroom,
said Laszlo, who knew very well what poltroon meant. Really, he was surprised that Drave did.
You are absolutely a mushroom, said Ruza. It means coward,
said Drave.
Oh,
Laszlo turned to Ruza.
Do you think I'm a coward?
Ruza considered the matter.
More of a mushroom,
he decided. To Drave.
I think you were closer the first time.
I never said he was a mushroom.
Then I'm confused.
I take it as a compliment,
Laszlo went on, purely for the infuriation of Drave. It was petty, but fun.
Mushrooms are fascinating. Did you know they aren't even plants?
Ruza played along, all fascinated disbelief.
I did not know that. Please tell me more.
It's true. Fungi are as distinct from plants as animals are.
I never said anything about mushrooms,
Drave said through gritted teeth.
Oh, I'm sorry. Drave, you wanted something.
But the explosionist had had enough of them. He flung out a hand in disgust and stalked off.
He's bored, poor man,
said Zara, with a flat lack of pity.
Nothing to destroy. We could at least give him a small neighborhood to demolish,
suggested Ruza.
What kind of hosts are we?
And Laszlo felt a fizz of uneasiness. A bored explosionist was one thing. A bored, disgruntled explosionist was another. But then the conversation took a turn that drove all thoughts of Drave from his head.
"I can think of a way to keep him busy," said Shimzin,
one of the other warriors.
"Send him up in a silk sleigh to blow the godspawn into blue stew."
Laszlo heard the words, but they were spoken so evenly, so casually, that it took him a moment to process them, and then he could only blink.
Blue stew.
"As long as I don't have to clean it up," said Ruza,
just as casually. They had been briefed earlier on the situation in the Citadel. Their blasé demeanor was certainly a cover for their deep disquiet, but that didn't mean they weren't absolutely in earnest. Zara shook her head, and Laszlo thought she was going to chide the men for their callousness, but she said,
"Where's the fun in that? You wouldn't even get to watch them die."
His breath erupted from him in a gust, as though he'd been punched in the gut. They all turned to him, quizzical.
"What's the matter with you?"
asked Ruza, seeing his expression.
"You look like someone served you blue stew for dinner."
He laughed, pleased with his joke, while Shimzin slapped him on the shoulder. Laszlo's face went tight and hot. All he could see was Sarai, trapped and afraid.
"How can you speak like that?" he asked.
"When you've never even met them."
"Met them?"
Ruza's eyebrows went up.
"You don't meet monsters. You slay them."
Zara must have seen Laszlo's anger, his stupefaction.
"Trust me, strange," she told him. "If you knew anything about them, you'd be happy to drop the explosives yourself."
"If you knew anything about me," he replied, "you wouldn't think I'd be happy to kill anyone."
They all squinted at him, puzzled, and annoyed, too, that he was spoiling their amusement. Ruza said,
"You're thinking of them as people. That's your problem. Imagine they're thieves."
"We didn't kill the thief."
"Well, that's true."
Ruza screwed up his face.
"Bad example. But would you have looked at me like that if I had?"
"I don't know. But they're not thieves."
"No,"
Ruza agreed.
"They're much more dangerous."
And that was true. But it missed the point. They were people. And you didn't laugh about turning people into stew. Especially not Sarai.
"You think good people can't hate?"
she'd asked Laszlo last night.
"You think good people don't kill?"
How naive he'd been, to imagine it was all a matter of understanding. If only they knew her, he told himself, they couldn't want to hurt her. But it was so clear to him now, they could never know her. They'd never let themselves. Suhaila had tried to tell him. The hate was like a disease. He saw what she meant. But could there ever be a cure? Could the people of Weep ever accept the survivors in the Citadel? Or, like the Thrieve in the desert, at least suffer them to live?
Chapter 51. Poltroons.
"There is a magnetic field between the anchors and the Citadel,"
Muzave, the natural philosopher, was telling Ketha, artist of siege engines, in the Guild Hall dining room.
"But it's like nothing I've seen before."
Drave, who was irrationally furious to find mushrooms on his plate, sat at the next table. The sullen look on his face gave no hint that he was listening. Muzave had invented an instrument he called a cryptochromometer that used a protein extracted from bird's eyes to detect the presence of magnetic fields. It sounded like a lot of flummery to Drave, but what did he know?
"Magnetic anchors,"
mused Ketha, wondering how he might appropriate the technology for his own engine designs.
So if you could shut them off, the Citadel would just float away. That's my best guess. How's it floating anyway, something that big?
A technology we can't begin to fathom, said Muzave. Not through Lola gas, that's for certain.
Kether, who was keen on appropriating that technology too, said sagely,
if anything's certain, it's that nothing's certain.
Drave rolled his eyes.
What's making it? He asked, gruff. The magnetic field. Is there machinery inside the anchors or something?
Muzave shrugged. Who knows? It could be a magical moon pearl, for all I can tell.
If we could get inside the damned things, we might find out.
They discussed the metallurgist's progress and Thion Nero's, speculating who would breach the metal hulls first. Drave didn't say another word. He chewed. He even ate the mushrooms while phrases like, breach the hulls, rang in his mind like bells. He was supposed to sit back while the Fellerings and Nero vied for the reward. As though Nero even needed it, when he could just make gold any day of the week.
He'd be damned if this bunch of poltroons were going to keep him from throwing his hat in the ring. Or more like, blowing the damned ring up.
Chapter 52. Amazing, but scorched. Sparrow had, in fact, tried to visit Sarai, but ghosts blocked the corridor and wouldn't let her through. The little girl ghost, Baha, dripping with river water and Dola, told her solemnly,
Sarai can't play right now,
which sent a chill up her spine. She went to the Ellens in the kitchen to see if they knew how she was, but she found them grim and silent, which sent another chill. They were never like this. It had to be Minya's doing, but Minya had never oppressed the nurses as she did the other ghosts. Why now? Minya was nowhere to be found, and neither were Ruby or Feral. Sometimes they all just needed a little time to themselves. That was what Sparrow told herself that afternoon in the Citadel. But she needed the opposite. She needed her family. She hated not being able to go to Sarai, and she was furious that she couldn't even find Minya to appeal to her. She went to the heart of the Citadel and called out through the narrow opening that had once been a door. She was sure Minya must be inside, but she never answered. Even the garden couldn't soothe her today. Her magic felt feeble, as though some river within herself were dry. She imagined herself weeping, and Feral holding her to comfort her. He would smooth her hair with his hands, and murmur soothing things, and she would look up, and he would look down, and it wouldn't be anything like when Ruby had kissed him, all sucking noise and storm clouds. It would be sweet, so sweet.
It could happen, she thought. Now, with everything so fraught.
Why not? The tears were easy enough to produce. She'd been holding them back all day. As for Feral, he could only be in his room. Sparrow wandered up the corridor, past her own room and Ruby's, all silent behind their curtains. She would feel very stupid later for imagining that Ruby wanted time to herself. She never did. To Ruby, thoughts were pointless if there was no one to tell them to the instant you had them. She came to Feral's door, and all was not silent behind his curtain.
How do I know you won't burn me?
Feral had asked Ruby days earlier.
Oh, that could only happen if I completely lost track of myself,
she'd said.
You'd have to be really good. I'm not worried.
It had been something of a slap, and Feral had not forgotten it. It created a conundrum, however. How could he make her eat those words without getting burned up for his trouble? These were dark days, and it was good to have a challenge to take his mind off ghosts and doom. Make Ruby completely lose track of herself while not ending up a pile of char. Ferrell applied himself. The learning curve was delicious. He was keenly attuned to Ruby's pleasure, in part because it could kill him, and in part because he liked it. He liked her pleasure. He'd never liked her better than when she was soft against him, breathing in surprised little gasps, or looking up at him from under her lashes, her eyelids heavy with hedonic contentment. It was all very, very satisfying, and never so much as when, finally, she made a sound like the sighing of doves and violins, and set fire to his bed. The scent of smoke, a flash of heat. Her lips were parted, and her eyes glowed like embers. Ferrell pushed himself away, already summoning a cloud. He had rehearsed emergency plans in his head. The air filled with vapor. The silk sheets, clenched in Ruby's fists, burst into flame. And an instant later, the cloud burst forth rain, severing the dove and violin sigh, and dousing her before the rest of her bonfire could kindle. She gave a little shriek and came upright in an instant. Rain lashed down at her, whilst Ferrell stood back safe and smug. To his credit, he kept the cloud no longer than strictly necessary, on top of which it wasn't even cold. It was a tropical cloud. He thought this quite a nice gesture, but the romance was lost on Ruby.
How rude!
She exclaimed, shaking water from her arms. Her blue breasts glistened. Her hair sluiced rivers down her back and shoulders.
Rude, Ferrell repeated. So the polite thing would be to uncomplainingly burn up?
She glared at him.
Yes.
He surveyed the scene.
Look,
he pointed out.
You've scorched my sheets.
She had. There were sodden, black-edged holes where she'd clenched them in her fists.
Do you expect me to apologize? Ruby asked.
But Ferrell shook his head, grinning. He didn't mean to rebuke her. On the contrary, he was gloating.
You lost track of yourself, he said. You know what that means, don't you? It means I'm really good.
Her eyes narrowed. Still entangled in Ferrell's sheets, she went full bonfire, lighting up like a torch and taking the whole bed with her. Ferrell groaned, but could only watch as his sheets, pillows, mattress, everything that was not Mazarthium, flamed and were eaten up, leaving nothing behind but hot metal and a smoking naked girl, with her eyebrows raised as though to say, "How's that for scorched sheets?" She didn't really look mad, though. A grin tugged at one corner of her mouth.
I suppose you have improved, she allowed.
It felt like winning at Quell, only much better. Ferrell laughed. He'd known Ruby all his life and been annoyed by her for half of it. But now he was simply amazed by the turn things could take between two people, and the feelings that could grow while you distracted yourself from the end of the world. He walked back over to her.
You've destroyed my bed, he said, congenial. I'll have to sleep with you from now on. Oh, really? Aren't you afraid I'll incinerate you?
He shrugged. I'll just have to be less amazing,
to be on the safe side. Do that, and I'll kick you out. What a dilemma.
He sat on the edge of the bare bed frame.
Be less amazing and stay alive, or be amazing and get scorched.
Mazarthium didn't hold heat. It was already back to normal, but Ruby's skin was not. It was hot, like a summer day or a really good kiss. Ferrell leaned toward her, intent upon the latter, and froze. At the same moment, they became aware of a movement in their peripheral vision. The curtain. It had been pushed aside, and Sparrow was standing there, stricken. Chapter 53. Tarnished Hearts. Sarai's dreams that day were not without their terrors, but, for a change, she was not without defenses.
"We'll chase them away," Laszlo had said. "Or else turn them into fireflies and catch them in jars."
She tried it, and it worked. And at some point in the evening, she found herself striding through a dark wood in a Tizocaine breastplate, carrying a jar full of fireflies that had recently been Ravids and Rasalas, and even her mother. She held up the jar to light her way, and it lit her smile too, fierce with triumph. She didn't meet Laszlo in the dream, not exactly. Perhaps her unconscious preferred to wait for the real thing. But she did relive the kiss, exactly as it had been, melting sweet and all too brief. And she woke exactly when she had before. She didn't bolt upright in bed this time, but lay where she was, lazy and liquid with sleep and well-being. At dawn, solitude had greeted her, but not this time. Opening her eyes, she gave a start. Minya was standing at the foot of her bed. Now she did bolt upright.
"Minya! Whatever happened to respecting the curtains?"
"Oh, the curtains,"
said Minya, dismissive.
"Why worry about curtains, Sarai, unless you've something to hide?"
She looked sly.
"Ruby and Feral do, you know. But curtains, well, they don't block out sounds very well."
She made exaggerated smooching noises, and it reminded Sarai of how they would giggle and gasp when she told them about the things that humans did in their beds. It was a long time since she'd done that. Ruby and Feral, though. It didn't really surprise her. While she'd been wrapped up in her own misery, life in the Citadel had gone on. "Poor Sparrow," she thought.
"Well, I'm not hiding anything," she lied.
Minya didn't believe her for a second.
"No? Then why do you look like that?"
"Like what?" Minya studied her, her flat gaze roving up and down so that Sarai felt stripped. Seen, but not in a good way. Minya pronounced, as though diagnosing a disease.
"Happy."
Happy? What a notion.
"Is that what this feeling is?"
she said, not even trying to hide it.
"I'd forgotten all about it." "What do you have to be happy about?"
"I was just having a good dream," said Sarai. "That's all." Minya's nostrils flared. Sarai wasn't supposed to have good dreams.
"How is that possible?"
Sarai shrugged.
"I closed my eyes, lay still, and..."
Minya was furious. Her whole body was rigid. Her voice took on the spittle-flying hiss, normally reserved for the word vengeance.
"Have you no shame? Lying there, all silky and wanton, having good dreams while our lives fall apart."
Sarai had plenty of shame. Minya might as well have demanded, "Have you no blood?" or "Have you no spirit?" Because shame as good as ran in her veins. But not right now. "I think you're a fairy tale." Funny how light she felt without it. "I think you're magical and brave and exquisite."
"I'm through with shame, Minya," she said. "And I'm through with Lull. And I'm through with nightmares. And I'm through with vengeance. Weep has suffered enough, and so have we. We have to find another way."
"Don't be stupid. There is no other way.
A lot of things could happen, Sarai had told Ruby, not believing it herself. That had been days ago. She believed it now. Things had happened. Unbelievable things. But where the Citadel was concerned, nothing could happen unless Minya let it. Sarai had to persuade her to let it. For years she'd stifled her own empathy and kept it in for fear of Minya's wrath. But now so much depended on it. Not just her love, but all their lives. She took a deep breath.
Minya, she said, you have to listen to me. Please. I know you're angry with me, but please try to open your mind.
Why? So you can put things in it? I'm not forgiving your humans, if that's what you think.
Your humans. And they were her humans, Sarai thought. Not just Errol Fane and Laszlo, but all of them. Because her gift had forced her, and allowed her, to know them.
Please, Min,
she said. Her voice fluttered as though it were trying to fly away, as she herself wished she could do.
Errol Fane didn't tell anyone what happened yesterday. He didn't tell them about me, or the ghosts.
So you have seen him,
Minya said with vindication.
You used to be a terrible liar, you know. I could always tell. But you seem to be improving.
I wasn't lying, said Sarai. I hadn't seen him, and now I have.
And is he well, our great hero?
No, Minya. He's never been well. Not since Izagol.
Oh, stop,
protested Minya, pressing a hand to her chest.
You're breaking my heart.
What hearts?
Asked Sarai.
The hearts you tarnish with miserable ghosts so that you can hold on to your hate.
The hearts I tarnish with miserable ghosts? That's good, Sarai. That's really poetic.
Sarai squeezed her eyes shut. Talking to Minya was like getting slapped in the face.
The point is, he didn't tell anyone. What if he's sick about what he did, and wants to make amends?
If he can bring them all back to life, then I'll certainly consider it.
You know he can't. But just because the past is blood, doesn't mean the future must be too. Couldn't we try talking to him? If we promise him safe conduct...
Safe conduct? You're worrying about his safety. Will Weep promise us safe conduct? Or don't you need us anymore? Maybe we aren't a good enough family for you now. You have to yearn for the man who killed our kind.
Sarai swallowed. Of course she needed them. Of course they were her real family and always would be. As for the rest, she wanted to deny it out of hand. When Minya put it like that, it appalled even her.
That's ridiculous, she said. This isn't even about him. It's about us and our future.
Do you really think he could ever love you?
The little girl asked.
Do you really think a human could ever stand the sight of you?
Until a week ago, Sarai would have said no. Or she wouldn't have said anything, but only felt the no as shame, wilting and withering her like an unwatered flower. But the answer had changed, and it had changed her.
Yes, she said, soft but resolute. I know a human can stand the sight of me, Minya, because there is one who can see me.
The words were out. She couldn't take them back. A flush spread up her chest and neck.
and he stands the sight of me quite well.
Minya stared. Sarai had never seen her gobsmacked before. For an